Hello and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortes Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CSCK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 FM, every Thursday and Saturday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and of course, wherever you get your podcasts. The City of Prince Rupert and the Ministry of Climate Change investigated the death of 19 eagles at the Coastal Communities Landfill. CICK's Dan Messick is sifting for truth in the investigation. The Terrace Sportsplex has opened a much-needed before-and-after-school daycare center in an attempt to tackle the lack of childcare in the north. CFNR's Sabrina Spencer is reporting on that from Terrace. Students enrolled in environmental science studies at UNBC are sharing their feedback from their AI accessibility walk on the campus of UNBC in Prince George. Ian Gregg from CFUR has got that story. Singer Joanna Finch is coming to Cortes Island for a performance and sound bath workshop after 24 years away from the island. Lonnie Taylor at CKTZ is on The Scoop with Joanna today. And finally, the BC government announced funding to bring high-speed broadband internet access to 310 homes in the Kootenay Lake area as part of a federal plan to connect 100% of Canadians to high-speed internet by 2030. Scott Onyeshek is on The Scoop today from Kootenay Co-op Radio.
2 months ago, 19 eagles were discovered at the Prince Rupert landfill covered in a deleterious substance that had been dumped in the liquid waste site at the landfill, according to a statement released by the City of Prince Rupert. All attempts to rescue the eagles failed, and as a result, 18 of them drowned, and one that workers were able to free from the unknown substance died following the recovery. An investigation has since been launched by the City of Prince Rupert and the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change to determine exactly what material was dumped and subsequently killed the eagles. However, officials say that the substance was not hazardous. Still, whoever did dump the unknown material could be facing charges and penalties pending an investigation. The incident, which only came to light last week, has impacted the community and especially many First Nations communities, which consider the eagle sacred and a conduit to the spirit world, also symbolizing respect, honor, strength, courage, and wisdom. Today, we'll check in with Arnie Nagy. He is a volunteer and spokesperson for the Prince Rupert Wildlife and Rehab Shelter, which helps rescue and rehabilitate injured animals along the North Coast. And I spoke with Richard Pucci. He is the Director of Operations and Government Relations for the City of Prince Rupert about why it took so long for the city to release information about the incident and what comes next in the hopes that this never happens again. Stay with us.
My name is Richard Pucci, and I'm the Director of Operations and Government Relations for the City of Prince Rupert and live and work in the City of Prince Rupert on Cochimshan property.
Great, Richard. Thanks so much for being with us here on CSAK News. Of course, devastating news coming out of Prince Rupert, but a little bit late. Can you tell me when the city first heard that this was happening and what came next in the recovery and cleanup of these animals?
We found out about the incident on January 4th, and we immediately contacted the Ministry of Environment and Environment Canada and Climate Change, and immediately started the cleanup that day. We rescued what we could of the eagles and had the eagle brought to the wildlife shelter, and then unfortunately the other ones had already perished.
Yeah. Richard, why did it take so long for the city to announce or release information about this incident? And it sounds like there's an investigation ongoing. Is that correct?
Well, it is an ongoing investigation with the Ministry of Environment, Canada, and Climate Change. So we've been working with them on cleanup activities. The city was doing what we were sort of told and brought to do by conservation and the ministry.
Yeah, of course. Richard, this happened a couple months ago, but tell me, what did the city find out once it actually heard that these eagles were trapped at the liquid waste facility in the landfill? Tell me, what actually happened to these eagles, and how did the city respond when you first heard about it?
Yeah, so what we believe happened is that the eagles landed in what usually is a pond, and unfortunately there was a substance on top, an organic substance that we are just getting the chemical makeup of. We know it is not a hazardous substance, it is an organic substance, and it coated their feathers, and unfortunately they weren't able to fly out, and we didn't get there in time to rescue them. But the cleanup has happened, and we've disposed of the material that was free product on top, and we were just waiting to figure out the remainder of the material to clean up.
My name is Arnie Nagy. I'm in Prince Rupert, and I'm a volunteer with the Prince Rupert Wildlife Shelter.
What was your first reaction when you heard the news?
Oh, I was angry. I was upset and basically speechless because I'm a member of the Haida Nations, and the eagle is my crest, and it's a crest to me. The eagle basically has a significant role in many of our First Nations all up and down the coast and in British Columbia, because that's the eagle is one of the main crests in almost all of the nations.
In Deloanne, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. Tariff Mayor Sean Bouitash was joined by Minister of Finance Katrine Conroy at the grand opening of the new before and after school daycare space at the Tariff Sportsplex. CFNR was at the ribbon cutting ceremony and later spoke with Cindy Hall, an early childhood educator for the City of Tariff.
Welcome and thank you for joining us today in our awesome new space for our young people. Since the program's soft launch last fall, it's been a lot of fun to see more and more kids, including my own, and programs in this space. Not only that, it's helping their parents and caregivers get back into the workforce, get to work on time, take classes, or any number of other pursuits, knowing their children are taken care of before and after school. Our 2020 Child Care Needs Assessment Action Plan lists an unmet demands for licensed child care spaces as one of the key needs for our community. Council has been committed to finding ways to ease the strain on both existing child care providers and local families since the completion of the action plan. The city was able to secure $390,000 from the Child Care BC New Space Fund, which helped us renovate this space, purchase a van for transportation, and equip both this room and outdoor component appropriately for young people to use. We are pleased to have Minister Conroy here today, and she will speak more to the funding. I would now like to turn this over to the Minister. Please welcome our Finance Minister, Minister Conroy.
Hey, John. So you might be wondering why is the Minister of Finance announcing the child care? Well, he said I was coming to Tariff. I wanted to do it. I was the Minister of Children and Family when we first started the BC Child Care Program, and I really want to thank the staff for all the work that you've done to make this happen. I know this just doesn't happen. I mean, yes, the province needs money to make it happen, but it's the people here that are doing the work. And the fact that the city is doing this is a big deal. It's, you're city employees, and that's the kind of partnership we're wanting to see right across the province. It's really important. I really want to thank you all. I'm so happy to be here. Congratulate the city and just say congratulations on this grand opening. It's worth it, and it's going to be so beneficial to not only to the families that benefit from the child care, but also the economy of Tariff, because when families have good, affordable child care, parents can afford to go back to work, go to school. In fact, since we started this program, over 100,000 women have returned to the workforce in BC, and majority of them attribute it directly to our child care program. So we know it's a good economic driver and a benefit to all the people here.
So my name is Cindy Hall, early childhood educator in the community for the past 30 years. We purchased a 13-passenger van so we could do transportation, because we recognize that transportation is a barrier for some families getting to the child care program. So we started that out right from the day one. It's been a little slow going because we started a little late in the year. We didn't start right in September, where we had thought, because of course everything is behind. So we started at the end of October. So we've started about half capacity, and we called that our soft start. So it worked out perfectly, ironing out all the kinks, learning how to, you know, manage getting the van to all the different schools and what we could manage, hiring staff, all those little pieces. So we've been able to sort of walk slowly through it. And every day we seem to get another call or another email, families needing care. So I foresee us being full for next September.
And then what is the capacity for this space?
We license for two spaces because there's a wall that we can put between the two rooms. We have 13 that's licensed on one half and 18 on the other. So it's 31 in total children can be a part of the program.
And then what is the age for the child care program?
So school age is considered 5 in kindergarten up to 12 grade 6. And we do have older ones. I had originally thought it would be more families that were really needing care for the younger kids, but I was quite pleasantly surprised to see that there's a really great mix. We've got a few kids that are 12 that are in our program. So we had to adjust a little bit about what we're going to offer, how we're going to offer it. And so we're learning that as we go too. But I think partly having these amenities that the kids can access, like the skating and the swimming and those things, that really speaks to the older age group. They've got lots of energy and they want to be able to use these things that the sports clubs offer. So it's worked out really well.
Great. Yeah. And then, so what are the hours then, it being a before and after school program?
School program starts at 7:30 in the morning, and then we drive them to school. So whatever time their school starts, and then we open again at 2:30 until 5:30 at night.
You can see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Mackenzie Holdis.
Hi, I'm Joel Yurt.
For the environmental sustainability class that we're taking.
Yeah, so we're about to head out on the AI accessibility walkthrough as part of Dr. Annie Booth's Environmental Studies 326 class, focusing on public engagement.
The instructor is Annie Booth. We're looking at a third-year undergraduate class. It is a mandatory class for anyone in the environmental science to take. We were presented with projects in the class, and we were
connected with a group of individuals and groups around the city that were interested in hosting some form of public engagement to forward the progress of their organizations. And my group here, we were matched up with the AAI. And after connecting with Dr. Anna Robinson and Dr. Mark Grew, we decided that it would be beneficial to host a accessibility walkthrough of the campus. So that's what we're on here today.
When we think of post-secondary education, many times we default to thinking of students arranged in a classroom, sitting in chairs, listening to a lecture for multiple hours. While that may be a common component of learning at the post-secondary level, some classes like this one, Environmental Studies 326, put students in the uncomfortable position of engaging with the public. This class is conducted in the Faculty of Environment, but as a consequence of engaging with the public, the project blends into other disciplines as well. Why is it important for you to attend the UMBC Accessibility Walk?
Brock, I've got an injury history that gives me back, knee, hip problems, as well as hearing loss and ADHD. So I've got a lot of factors that affect how I interact with facilities that aren't readily apparent. So just being able to weigh in from some of those lacks from somebody who isn't part of a visible disability group was important to me.
From the institutional perspective, or, you know, not UMBC necessarily, but just many organizations feel that if they're not hearing from a certain demographic, then that demographic must not exist, must not want to attend. Do you feel like there's an issue of the university not coming to us?
I think just generally that most people, unless there's some kind of forum or discourse started by the company, the institution, unless it's incredibly problematic for them, they don't voice their opinion about what these deficiencies are because they feel like they're being a problem as opposed to being encouraged to ask for this feedback. I feel that, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, but in a lot of these settings, for me, my difficulties with the institutional provisions provided and accommodations aren't readily apparent that I need certain accommodations. So I'm not approached for feedback, whereas someone who's in a wheelchair with mobility problems is approached for that feedback. So their needs are addressed eventually, but the at-large university population isn't.
Thank you. Like any organized research, this accessibility assessment walkthrough has parameters and limitations in place.
Thank you for coming here today. We're going to be going to four kind of main areas throughout the school and doing quick accessibility assessments in these areas. We're going to do the first floor of the library just over here. The entrance is off of the accessible parking lot, as well as the Camp 4 lecture theater and the cafeteria. A little bit of a variety to see the many different barriers that may present themselves and begin to brainstorm how we might be able to make things work better.
The following is a hyper-condensed sample of the UMBC accessibility assessment walkthrough, starting with the UMBC library. A notable example, in the library, many high chairs and high tables with a work surface approximately 4 feet high were observed.
I think the number of like really high tables and counters is a design choice in here. Like, I don't know.
What was the point? Is it comfort?
I don't know.
It's trendy.
Attention shifted to seating that was conversely too low and not clearly marked.
Yeah, you can't put a chair under nothing.
Like even these seats, like if you were to, like say your friends wanted to sit there and you wanted to sit with them, you'd kind of be, like maybe like taking one or two of them away for a person with a disability who still wants to sit in this sort of area.
Exactly.
Getting the percentage of accessible.
Moving out of the library and into a UMBC classroom, where table placement, design, and presentation podium presented frustrating limitations.
Where would somebody with a disability be able to operate the braking system?
Yeah.
There's probably a better solution than that. We're going to be taking a more objective look at these spaces as well and seeing if the personal experiences that were shared today can match up with the standards that these spaces are supposed to have.
In many cases, the codes don't actually meet the needs of individuals. Who is the target audience for this data, by the way? Obviously, you know, the public's going to be able to see it, but who are you really hoping is going to see this data?
I think we're hoping that some decision makers around at UMBC will see this data and be able to look at it and see that accessibility is not where it needs to be here on campus, and hopefully we can help spark that change and help to create a more barrier-free environment.
Thanks so much for your time, Joel. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CKTZ News Update. I'm Lonnie Taylor. Joanna Finch is coming to Quadra Island and Cortez for a tour of her show Ephemeral Tides. The Salish Sea Siren will be performing folk, cabaret, original songs, and poems inspired by lifetime adventures in the Salish Sea.
So this is your first time coming to Cortez to perform in it 24 years.
I was at Linnea too. I worked as a volunteer at Linnea. I volunteered at Linnea for the Power of Hope. I have on Quadra, many times on Quadra at the Harriet Bay Inn playing jazz. But yeah, I can't even remember the last time was that I played there. So it's really exciting.
So in addition to performing, you're also going to be offering a workshop.
That's right. Yes. So the workshop is improvisational singing, soul singing is what I call it, because I help people to release their voices. And through a lot of tricky little games that people find themselves just laughing and having fun, and I know everybody's really singing from the heart. There are a lot of people that are doing this kind of thing. I think the style of it was invented by Bobby McFerrin.
So as far as the workshop goes, what kind of people do you think would be interested? Do you need any experience to sign up?
Really, it's always easier for people if they are not shy about opening their mouth and singing. But if they're particularly shy and uncomfortable with that, it could be a real breakthrough for them. It's pretty much suitable for anybody because there's not a lot of demand. The only ask is that if you're going to come, to be willing to make a sound. And it doesn't have to be a perfect sound. And it doesn't have to be what your idea is of being a singer. It's not really about singing so much as it is about being able to allow the voice to come out. So from all ranges, really, I think it would be suitable for youth that are 16 plus, and then any all ages. I'm doing regular classes right here in the Comox Valley right now. And I think the oldest participant is in her mid 70s. And I've had people that are in their 80s before. So really, it's for everybody. And it can be fairly energetic too. We do a fair bit of movement with it as well. So it can be energizing.
Nice. Is there a cost for the workshop?
$30 for the workshop and $20 for the, so it's for, if you go to both, and it's $50 for both the concert and the workshop.
Yes. So admission to the concert on the 16th is $20, and the workshop the next day on March 17th is $30. 16 and up, anybody can come that wants to break through and sing. And is there anything else that you want to share about the offerings that you're bringing to Cortez?
I just hope that there will be a good turnout for both events because they're both really fun and they're both, I'm full of love and I want to share that. I want my stories and songs to touch people, and the feeling of exhilaration I get when I get to step back and watch people interact in these workshops is just deeply satisfying. So to be able to observe that, to witness people having fun and to finding their voice. And it's also very soulful to these moments where it's deeply personal and touching. And it's a real honor. It's really an honor to be able to bring that to people. So I'm really happy that I get to come and play. I'm so happy too that I've had the support of the Gorge Hall Society to help out with making sure, spreading the word and everything. It really makes a difference. It's hard doing everything all on your own. It's really great having the community behind.
On March 15th, Joanna Finch will be playing at The Cove on Quadra Island at 7 p.m. And on March 16th, she'll be playing at the Gorge Hall on Cortez Island at 7 p.m. Both shows are $15 to $25 on a sliding scale. And she will also be offering a sound bath and soul song vocal workshop on March 17th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Gorge Hall. The workshop is $30 to $45 on a sliding scale, or if you want to attend the concert and the workshop, it's $50 total.
Lonnie Taylor, CKTZ News, Cortez Island.
In a press release on March 4th, the NDP government announced more than $1 million in provincial and federal funding to bring high-speed internet to 310 homes in the rural Kootenai Lake area. Local MLA Brittany Anderson spoke to the importance of having high-speed internet.
Connecting rural British Columbia is an incredible priority for our government. We know that high-speed internet is not a luxury. It's important for things like businesses, it's important for workers, it's important for education, and it's just important for connecting people. So I am really thrilled to see that we're investing in our region and connecting areas like Johnson's Landing to high-speed internet.
This funding will feed two separate projects. The first project will connect 262 homes in Ainsworth, Hot Springs, Argenta, Cooper Creek, Hauser, Caslow, Lardo, Meadow Creek, and Shuddy Bench. The provincial and federal governments each provided over $420,000 for this project. And the second project will connect 48 homes in Johnson's Landing, Caslow, and Riendell. The provincial and federal governments each provided almost $100,000 for this project. Anderson also mentioned that the BC government and Premier David Eby are committed to looking at all issues through a rural lens.
I've had multiple meetings with David Eby, our premier, and he definitely recognizes the importance of having a thriving rural British Columbia. And so one of the pieces that I'm really excited about is that we're working on a rural lens so that all government decisions that are made right now, you know, when something goes to cabinet or treasury board, it's analyzed through a gender-based analysis and also through reconciliation. And a third piece to that is going to be including the rural lens. So how does the delivery of our services impact rural people and is it equitable? And that's something that I've personally been pushing for with the support of my colleagues, and our premier has been really open to it and we're working hard on that. And I think we're doing better now, but I think we're going to be doing even better in the future for delivering for rural British Columbians. And I could not be more excited and proud of that work.
As for the timelines for the internet projects, some communities are expected to get service by the end of 2024, while others will have to wait till the end of 2026. These timelines align with the federal and provincial government's goal to connect all Canadians to high-speed internet. Their goal is to connect 98% by 2026 and 100% by 2030. Reporting in Nelson, Scott Onschuk, KCR News.